Welcome back to The Great Game. This is episode 29, and we were rejoined by two Australian Mega Game friends, Nili from Melbourne Mega Games and Justin from Adelaide Mega Games, to have a chat about how we each got to where we are in the Mega Game world and how we got our communities up and running. Definitely ended up being a little bit more of a nostalgic chat about the war stories and the experiences we've had, rather than a bit of a sort of guide to setting up a mega game community. But nonetheless, it was a really enjoyable conversation, and hopefully you can take something away from it. Enjoy.
So we're here with Justin from Adelaide Mega Games and Nelly from Melbourne Mega Games. Why don't we just get things started? Nelly, for anyone who hasn't known you before from your appearances on the podcast, would you like to just tell people who you are?
Yes. So I run Melbourne Mega Games, which I started with Tristan Cliff back in 2019. Outside of Mega Games, I'm currently doing my PhD on how museums use games. So Mega Games do come up in that a little bit. I am known for talking about fun and fun in serious games, of which Mega Games are kind of a loose cousin. When people ask, you know, well, when people say, how do we define what a mega game is, and then decide to get around that by being like, well, what really is a game? I have been known to share some thoughts, TM. I might leave it at that for now.
And Justin.
Hi there. I'm Justin. I'm one of the founders of Adelaide Mega Games, and ex-Sydney Mega Gamers player and game maker, who then, yeah, moved across the country and got established here. And I think everyone else is, we don't need to go into detail about anything else. That's all boring, real life stuff. I don't have anything that's tangentially related.
Fair enough. So this episode is going to be diving into all about starting mega game communities and how to get things started, how to build that kind of community spirit and the among players and facilitators, and yeah, get things rolling, I guess. To kick things off, I guess Pat and I started, I think we both started around in 2014. Is that right, Pat?
Yeah, I think And I think that's the year of the infamous video. So we both sort of jumped on that clearly and got our start probably near the second half of that year, I'd say. I think mine was November.
Yeah, I think, it's been too long now. It is coming up on the 10-year anniversary, which is crazy, and I feel very old. But I don't remember exactly when it was. I'll start off quickly. The way I started off things was basically just a thread on Board Game Geek Brisbane popped up saying, wow, this game is really great, someone should run one. And a lot of people were kind of posting like, yeah, it'd be really great if only someone would run this. And eventually I was like, okay, I'll see what I can do, and kind of got things started from there. Pat, how did things get started on your side, and then we might go around?
Yeah, it was pretty similar. I think I just made a Facebook, I saw the video, and I think I gave the shut up and sit down video, I should say. And so I shared that with a few people I knew. And then once I got validated by them, who, you know, saying that, yes, it's a good idea, I think I just made an event or a group on Facebook and just started spamming people with that, friends and family and what have you. And I think we really got our start when a friend of mine shared it down to the Wollongong Uni, and I think that is where, Justin, you made your entrance.
Absolutely.
The Physics Society, I think. And that seemed to just get us a huge amount of support. It also led me to the huge amounts of anxiety I had for the first game that I ever ran, but we can talk about that later. Mm. But yeah, it was homegrown through Facebook, just word of mouth.
Yeah, I think absolutely same here. And then Nelly, how did things get started off in Melbourne?
So when we started in Melbourne, we actually still had Pulp Mega Games down in Geelong, which is a little bit out of Melbourne, maybe like an hour and a half by car. That might be an exaggeration. It might be only an hour. And they were running games, a couple of games a year, I want to say. And I was, Tristan and I were at university, and we were part of the Tabletop Board Gaming Society. I think a few people in that group had gone to play some of Pulp's games, and Tristan was like, this is fantastic. We should see if they can come and run one for TGS. And so they did. And I played in that game with a couple of people who are very much still around Melbourne Mega Games. And then Tristan was like, I really want more of this to happen in Melbourne. And I was like, I would also like more of this to happen in Melbourne. Let's just do it. So we asked Pulp if they minded us doing that because we didn't want to step on their toes. And they were very supportive. And they actually loaned us their copy of Watch the Skies. And it's now become kind of an Australian tradition that we share our games with each other and the printed components, even when the distance is a little bit further than an hour by car, as Justin can attest. but yeah, we ran Watch the Skies as our first game, and it kind of spiraled from there. And to Pat's comment about the anxiety, I think I just didn't know enough about Mega Games before running the first one that I was like, can't possibly be anxious. the anxiety came later. But yeah, I played one and I was like, yeah, no, we can do this. This is fine. And that has kind of been the attitude the whole way through.
I just remember, I mean, I specifically shouted out Justin there because I remember my anxiety being on the day, you know, having it all in my head and having produced this game and prepared, you know, to get all these different people involved with it that I didn't know. And then it was on the day when all these strangers started like arriving. And then Justin and James and his team arrived and they were all dressed up in military outfits, you know, as the China Republic.
Glory to China.
Yeah. And I was just like, holy shit, I'm really in way of my head. These people all know exactly what they're doing and I don't. But yeah, anyway, I won't interject too much. Justin, how did you get your start other than that in Sydney? How did you get your start in Adelaide?
Well, I mean, it was, you know, we've got to give credit to you, Pat, because that first game was just, it was magnificent. It was so good. I had such a great time. And I was instantly hooked. And then after like a few years of being a player, I began to dip my toes into designing games, and then that was something I really wanted to continue. And then in 2020, I had to move to Adelaide for work and did a bit of digging around and saw there wasn't a community here, so I kind of took it upon myself to make that happen. And then Nelly was kind enough a few years later Nelly was kind enough to put me in touch with the president of the Adelaide University Games Club, who also, they had run a mega game for their like own club members, and they wanted to do it again, but like to run a bit of a bigger game and a more ambitious game, which was actually God Emperor, Jack's baby. and so, yeah, we got my partner Katie and I, we got in touch with Monty and his crew at the Games Club, and we came on board to kind of to help them out. And then that kind of gave me the springboard that I needed to get back into it after being a little bit derailed by COVID. And here we are.
Yeah. And so Adelaide kind of got their real start, main start last year. Is that right?
2023? Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. 2023.
Yeah. And so I suppose like, so we're still representing only a sliver of the Australian potential geography, but I thought just for those listening, all of these cities, so Brisbane down to Sydney, that's a good 9-hour drive or more. Sydney to Melbourne, that's another 9 to 10 hours. And then I think Melbourne over to Adelaide is probably another 8 hours or so. So,
yep. Done that drive many times.
So there's,
I'm about to do that drive.
Yeah. With a bunch of fairy belongings in the back. which will be fun.
No fruit or vegetables, please. Otherwise, you get stopped at the border.
Good to know.
Yeah, so it's you know, it sounds like we're propping up all over the place, but it has taken us a while, and we are very spread out. So I'm not sure. You know, my general feeling is that maybe we've got that in common with the United States community, in that they have a lot of little groups propping up over the last decade, but they are spread out quite a bit. I think the European scene is quite different, in that they are a lot closer, and they just pop on over to each other's little town halls every weekend to play a new game.
Yeah, it was when I was in the UK at the start of this year, I had a bit of a look around to see if there are any games on that I could go to. Unfortunately, there weren't any that were being run while I was there. But there were so many game groups, even just in the UK. Like, there's just this incredible density of communities running mega games.
And I think my impression of the US, US listeners can correct me, but it seems like there are some big tentpole events like Gen Con where a lot of mega games are run, whereas I don't think we quite have anything like that at the moment in Australia. Like, we're not running mega games at PAX or anything at this stage. We do still, it is still wonderful how much people are able to, duck over for each other's mega games around here. So you do recognize a lot of the faces, but yeah, it is quite spread out. So
yeah, it does feel like we're a very tight knit community, though. Like, I feel that there's lots of strong ties, especially between like our four groups.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think we need to be, because it's still a
us even against the world, Pat.
It is. Yeah, we've got several groups, and we're doing quite a bit within them. But broadly across Australia, it is still a very scarce space. And so I think we've got to lean on each other to promote that quite a bit. So Justin, kicking off last year, technically, how many games is Adelaide on?
I've been a part of one game that we've run. We're about to run our first game for the year as of recording this. Next week we'll be running Phase Anatomy, which is in April, which is our first game for 2024. And then we've got another game slated for July, which has not yet been announced. And then I'm hoping to do a third one at the end of the year. So that should be, by the end of the year, four games that Adelaide Mega Games, as a like an official group, has facilitated.
Nice.
And Nelly, since you formally became Melbourne Mega Games, how many have you guys managed to put together?
So 8 unique games. We tend to do 2 games back-to-back. Which we started when we ran It Belongs in a Museum, which has a like low 30s player count, I think. And the first game, which was scheduled for April of 2020, I think like sold out in 5 hours. And we went, I reckon we could do a second one. and so we scheduled a second one, and then we unscheduled both of those very quickly. But yeah, so 8 unique games, but I think 13, 14 or 15 different game events, depending on if you count when we came up to Sydney twice to run 2 different versions of the Arc.
And Jack, you've had several Watch the Skies in Brisbane, right?
We have. I think we're still only... So we've been pretty lax compared to you two. We've only run about, I'd say, 6 or so over the 10 years. It's like one every 2 years or 3 years or something that we get into. But yeah, we've run quite a few Watch the Skies and quite a few variants of it. I'm not sure if I count... Well, maybe I'll count the online ones we tried out a bit over COVID, like A Dark and Stormy Night, which was an interesting experiment. But yeah, that's basically it for us. And Pat, in Sydney... How much have you gotten through now?
Well, I was just going to say, on the online ones, I think they count if we learnt from them, and I think we did. So
we did. I would say so.
They count. Yeah. I think we're similar to Melbourne. Before COVID, we were running one a year, and it was always an individual game. But we also had a gap in there. I think 2018 maybe. We've really kicked things off just before. In 2019, we had a couple of unique games, and then since then we have run three, including Nelly and when you and Leon came up to run the arc. Yeah. So I think we're at about 10 or 11 individual games and around 14 or 15 events.
Nice.
But ramping that up very quickly, which is exciting. Yeah.
It's really exciting. I think there's definitely been a lot of energy, it feels like, to me, coming out of COVID and everything. It's been awesome to see everything pop off.
Yeah. So we've got a breadth of of background, I suppose, with our different groups here. Wanted to sort of steer us back to sort of the first year of establishing things and sort of just compare war stories and figure out how we all got our different starts. I'm interested in particular to see how your first year compares, Justin, to ours back in 2014 and 2018. I'm not sure, Jack, I'm kind of interested if you wanted to jump in first and just sort of...
Yeah.
Run us through what it all was like for you at the very start.
Share your sage wisdom, please.
Yeah.
Well, you see, back in those days...
harking back to 2014.
What you did in those days is, the first thing is you made a Facebook page, as was the custom at the time. and then people just rolled in. I don't know. It was so... The Board Game Geek thread started based on that we... set up the Brisbane Mega Game Facebook group and tried to connect with, local board game groups and things like that. But I think we had it pretty easy, to be honest. It felt like it was pretty... People were really excited for something like this to happen. So it didn't feel like it was that tough to market, and we didn't know anything about marketing, obviously. We were just kind of, doing our best. Tickets for our first Watch the Sky, we posted a bunch of things like, hey, here's the models we're making. We tried to chat to people and get people into that group as like the main way we were talking to people. And based on it was pretty crazy. I guess there was such a groundswell of enthusiasm after the video that it was a bit easy. We even had one guy, David from New Zealand, who flew over to Brisbane to play in the game, which was crazy. I was like, David, maybe wait for our like second game, maybe for like after we know what we're doing. But he was like, no, I'm coming. I would imagine it was probably quite, I can't really give much sage wisdom, I would say, because I don't think, my impression is that Facebook is kind of a dying platform. Like I wouldn't do things the same way now, but obviously I think connecting to local board game groups and things like that would still be a great idea. What about you, Pat? You you were starting the same year.
Like I said, it was pretty similar. Watch the video, bought Watch the Skies, read Watch the Skies, decided I wanted to rewrite Watch the Skies, and then I did that, and arguably it was no better, but I did it. I learned. It was similar. Set up things on Facebook, start talking to friends, really leaned on my board game and role-playing game sort of groups that I was already involved with. Also leaned on, at that time, I roped in my brother, who was really coming at it from a political science kind of lens. So he disappeared pretty early on in the years, but he was there for the first one. A family friend of mine who was a teacher who was interested in that, how it might apply to sort of high school kids and as a teaching mechanism. So we had a whole bunch of different sort of odds and ends who came together and helped me run the game. I had no concept of how to get a control team together or a facilitator team. I had no concept of how to prep them. I just got a team together. I wrote some materials. I emailed them around and they all said, this seems fine. I don't know what this is meant to be at the end, but it looks good. Like I said, on the day, I relied a lot on word of mouth, and I can't even begin to explain how that happened, but we've managed to fill seats. A lot of people showed up. I had major regrets the morning of when I saw all these people that I didn't recognize. And then I will never be able to recreate the feeling I had when the game started and people just started doing stuff. And I didn't know what they were doing. And it turns out they all just figured out how to play this game. But yeah, I think it went relatively well. It was a first for a lot of people. I think we were sort of privileged back then in that. I mean,
I can confirm it went super well.
I think there's a lot of, I think it's 10 years ago. I think our vision and memory of it has been tarnished a little bit, Justin. But,
sure. No, absolutely not.
but I think that, I mean, these days, I think people are still leaning on that video, right, as their main intro to the hobby. There's new things as well. There's TikToks like that Becky has been doing. There's a lot more content online if people go Googling it. So maybe people have a better better idea of what to expect now. Whereas back then, people saw this video, and because it was done by, YouTube celebrity guys, and it was also from overseas, people, this was all that they had to taste, and so there was nothing to compare it to. So I think I was very lucky, I think. It's probably the word that it was so successful enough to push it forward, because I know that if that day hadn't have gone well, regardless of how little experience I had, that I probably would have, packed it in and just said, well, one and done. But people enjoyed it and they kept asking for more, and I had to figure out what the hell I was going to do next, which was a whole other learning experience. But yeah, 5 years later or so, How did you find, Nelly? You went into setting up Melbourne with a little bit of mega game experience under your belt, right?
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't think any game has ever gone like the time has passed so quickly as during the first one. I think that our later ones now, I feel every hour, and I'm like, come on, let's keep going. Yeah. That first game, I think, like round one started. The US decided to announce the presence of aliens. A bunch of other things happened. And then we went to the pub.
Yeah.
But yeah, because we started out of a university society that had, I want to say, a couple of hundred members, and definitely a core group of very committed, regular board game players. They would run Wednesday 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. and Friday 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. And just set up in rooms on campus, and people would be there for that entire time playing games. So that was a really easy pool to draw from. And then because we were a university group at the time, we got free access to room booking, which I think Justin can probably speak to as well. So we got a game that was loaned to us and a free venue. And I think we charged $5
yes. for
the student tickets, and maybe $10 if you weren't a student. And that worked beautifully. Game sold out. It was great. I think I do remember being at Officeworks the at Friday night before the game, printing stuff for the science game. And just being like, yeah, this is fine. It took me, I think, 3 or 4 games to learn from that.
Yeah.
And to go to Officeworks the week before. Although now I make Leon do it. It is my least favorite job. I sent him to Officeworks with a spreadsheet and a USB, and I don't have to deal with the poor printing person who's like, okay, yes, I can print 3A1 pieces for you.
You know you can submit those online now, right?
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Someone still does have to pick it up, though.
Yeah, and you can't watch over their shoulder as they sort of potentially screw up lots of things. Your problem.
Well, as I, even from Watch the Skies, I did visual redesign because, I care a lot about accessibility and things being kind of visually friendly. And when I picked up Watch the Skies, I was like, I don't want to play this game from looking at it.
Yeah.
So I made it look like something I would want to play. And I think that did it a huge favor. I will say our second game, Pat brought down. And so that was another, we got a university venue, we got a game loaned to us. I think we covered the cost of your flights and accommodation.
Yeah, that was your second.
What?
That was our second game.
Wow.
And all of the money, all of the income that we made over these first two games, we put towards a bar tab at the pub, and we got to the third game and we were like, oh, we don't have any money in the bank. And now we have actual printing costs.
Oh boy.
Sorry, everyone, there will be no bar tab for this game. And then we had to start actually charging people a real amount of money. And it, so it jumped up for our third game and up again for our fourth game. And it's kind of been stable since the fourth game.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was your second when I went down. That was 2019.
Yeah. I was also not in the country for that one. So I ran Watch the Skies. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to Germany end of 2019. And Tristan was like, yeah, okay, cool. I'm going to get Pat to come and run a game. And I was like, seems good. That happened. I do remember because we then planned to run It Belongs in a Museum. I feel like I did a podcast episode with you guys while I was in Germany about Watch the Skies and where we were going with IBAM. I have a very distinct memory of that because it's when I conceptualized the game that I am now only just like properly designing.
And I think
it was we were very.
No, sorry, I was just going to say, I think that was like our second episode, and it must have been right before, you know, we were told COVID was going to be a real thing, basically.
Well, because we planned IBAM while I was overseas. We came back, we had a venue we'd set up with an actual museum. You can see where I started getting ideas for other things. We just, like, we were fully ready to run that game. And one of our friends who is in public health was like, have you guys thought about, like, having hand sanitizer and stuff like that? And we were like, all right, that seems a bit much, but we'll consider it. And then we canceled the games. And I think really uniquely, we got two games out in 2021 just by being very lucky in that we rescheduled IBAM for April of that year. Melbourne, despite having the most lockdowns, wasn't in lockdown during that period. And by the time we came out the other end of that, Leon had designed the Ark. And so we just worked the Ark up until it was ready. And we were out of lockdown at the end of the year. And I think we might have been one of the only groups in the world that managed to get multiple games out in 2021, because I think everyone else just took a long nap.
Yeah. Yep. I remember it because we were planning to sort of come out of hibernation as well, but things didn't stay open here for the right window that we needed. So it was very impressive that you guys managed to get games out that year at all.
It was just lucky, I think. And we were optimistic.
And just, so going back to the pre-COVID games, the first and the second that you ran, like you said, you kind of already had a bit of experience of what you were getting yourself into with Pulp and having played some games. How did you go about, you said that you managed to get the venue sorted through the uni, which I'll quickly add on, my first games were also run at a public library, which was free, which was very, not the most fit for purpose location, but it was free and we had a great arrangement there. But how did you, so your venue was sorted and you've got a bit of experience of what to expect. What was your strategy for going about pulling your first team together for that Watch the Skies to help you run it?
So when Pulp came and ran God Emperor for the club, half of that facilitator team were from Pulp, and the other half were just people from the club who were on committee and who I think had played probably some of Pulp's games. So we grabbed all of them, and then a couple of other friends who were good at board games and who were like interested and excited. And I don't think we even had a meeting. I think we just sent everyone the rules and said, all right, show up at this time. And that seemed to work fine. I think I then, I do remember I went, because I went away, I had no involvement in setting up the team for the Crown, Pat's game. But because I was away, there were no women on that facilitator team. So when I came back for the third game, I like very assertively was like, all right, we're going to specifically ask a bunch of our female players and our gender diverse players if they'd like to come and be on this control team. And at some point recently, we tipped over into we often have more women and gender diverse people on our facilitator teams than we do cis men, which is really nice. But it was very much because I made a concerted effort from the start. But yeah, I think we just asked our friends and have progressively like opened that up more publicly.
And I think you sort of touched on the budget ever so slightly, but it kind of sounds like similar experience to what I had and maybe what Jack had up in Brisbane as well, where it was totally not sort of budgeted for and the ticketing barely covered things. Like, how did you come out the back end of Watch the Skies, the first one that you ran?
I think the budget was like $400 and half of that was spent on booze. Because we had all the game components, and so we just did some Officeworks printing, and we were like, cool, drinks on us. And yeah, then by the time we got round to the first game where we had to get our own components, I think we just did a more of a budget. And I think that was part of the decision to run a second game, or to try and run a second game, was that we were thinking, well, if we've produced this game and it cost us this much money, if we run it a second time, then, and like we've budgeted it for one game, all of the income that we get from the second game can go towards like resourcing and venues. Because the third game we ran, we also got the venue in kind. So it kind of, we, not necessarily on purpose, I do think this was a fluke, we kind of just built it up gradually and built our capacity and matured those processes as we did them a few times.
Yeah, nice. Which I think is what a lot of us go through. I just know that first round is a bit of shell shock. I didn't get to spend any money on booze for my first round, though, so you've got that over me.
I'm so sorry.
We went pretty crazy with our first round in terms of components. We physically printed out all the rule books and packaged them in like little brown envelopes and sent it, email and posted it to everyone.
Awesome. Players
as like a secret, you know, briefing, looking kind of thing.
I've always wanted to do that.
Love it.
I'll do it for my spy game.
That would be great. Look, I'll tell you what, if you do that, people do read the rules. That's the advantage of it.
Yeah.
Oh, you cracked it.
I
mean,
that's the secret.
I'll just get people to give me their addresses and then I'll just hand deliver them. Like, I'll just drive out and be like, all right, here you go. And then only post the ones for, you know, the interstate folks.
We did that for our first few games in Sydney, or at least the first one. And then I remember with our pirate game, which was years later, maybe 2018, we did a deluxe version where you could pay extra to get it posted to you. And it came in like a special, it was all on parchment, and it came in a special brown envelope with a custom wax seal that was made of the game's logo. But that was getting on the back end of the idea of people wanting hard copy stuff, and I think only like seven or eight people opted in to get that deluxe version. But it's a soft spot for me. I would love to get back to getting physical briefs. I remember getting them in the mail for Pulp, one of the Pulp games that I went down to. And I remember meeting at a pub with friends and talking, like you said, Jack, reading the rules and talking throughout like what we wanted to do in the game, which you just I feel is missing a bit these days.
Yeah, I wonder if that will come back, if that would be more popular now with kind of a newer and different crowd.
Possibly.
I think we, because of our experiences with Watch the Skies, where the US team like set the Terra Tractor 50 in round two, we've been pretty like don't pre-strategize. You don't know what anyone else is going to do. But maybe we should go back to encouraging. But
yeah,
that's a nice thing for people to do before the game.
I think it suits a certain type of game and a certain type of theme, maybe. But yeah, those geopolitical games where you're meant to be the head of state and you get a little dossier and print it off and everything, that's pretty fitting, pretty immersive.
I think we also got some feedback from one of the Watch the Skies players that has never come up in a game since, in that on the morning he was given a briefing on the day that was like, you hate this other, like, chief scientist. And so he spent his whole game, like, trying to undermine, I think it was China in the science game. And he was like, that was the best player experience I had at a mega game. Because you gave me something really, like, directed, but also it was delivered kind of secretly on the morning.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's interesting. Just reminded me of that.
Yeah, yeah. Justin, starting many, many years after the rest of us, how did, once you got involved with Adelaide, how was your first game as far as getting people together, doing the budget, that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, the work had kind of already been done for me with God Emperor. So that was very much just Katie and I kind of bashing down the door and adding ourselves onto the team that Monty had already assembled. And, like, they were very gracious about it, and they were, like, happy to accept, like, whatever advice we had. But it wasn't it wasn't until December of 2023 when we also ran Watch the Skies, which was the first game that, like, we had done, like, with, I guess, with me kind of running it and doing everything ourselves. And I just kind of piggybacked on everything that had already been done. And, you know, I was conscious of everything I had experienced as a player during the early days of Sydney Mega Games, and having observed Sydney Mega Games kind of grow into what it had become at the time. I just kind of reverse engineered everything that I had seen and that I thought worked well about how you do things in Sydney.
I thought you were going to say you just looked at what we do and did the opposite.
No, absolutely not. No, what are you talking about? But so yeah, I just kind of, used what I had seen in Sydney and, like, what I had experienced as both a player and a facilitator in Sydney, just to kind of guide the things I was doing, you know. So we had, and I did kind of use the experience running God Emperor to, like, suss out some people who I thought might be, like, some good choices, good, like, natural choices to kind of continue doing this, you know, behind the curtain, as it were. Yeah, so it was very, things, yeah, we're very fortunate that we had that really, like, open door opportunity just to kind of walk in and do, like, a soft kind of launch, assess how much interest there was, kind of get the lowdown on who might be interested to continue doing this, you know, as a more regular thing. Yeah, it was, things were just, we were super fortunate that the stars kind of aligned, and that both Monty and I happened to be at a Melbourne mega game in January of that year. And that Nelly knew about it.
Yeah, yep.
You're so welcome.
The Mega Game Matchmaker.
That's what MM stands for,
this
right?
Is, don't put this on me.
Yeah, so it does sound much like, I mean, having, you're just kind of insulated by these other communities, so it sounds like it was a smoother experience. What's the experience like in Adelaide with venues?
Well, I'm still, because a lot of our, like, core, like, control team are still members of the Adelaide Uni Games Club, we're still kind of parlaying that into free or very, very, very heavily subsidized venue hire. So it's been pretty good so far. I'm sure that the runway on that is going to run out soon-ish. So, you know, I know that day is coming, but for now, for, you know, our first couple of games, at least, before we wear out the goodwill of the nice people at the Games Club, We're yeah, saving a whole bunch. So I mean, of potential kind of outlays. So it's quite nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
I think I feel like a lot of groups followed that same trajectory where the early years there's some kind of deal that you've cut with a venue or you've found a place that you can get hold of cheap. I know that we were relying on the library that we started in Sydney for 3 or 4 years maybe. And then I think once we left that and sort of had to get out of these I mean, it was where I lived, so I loved it there, but it was a pretty obscure outer suburb of Sydney. Once we moved out of that space, we had to really start seriously thinking about budget, and that was one of the main drivers to incorporating with Sydney as well, becoming a not-for-profit association, because it really helps us as a community group get good prices, especially when we're dealing with councils. So that has been a big driver for us here. But there was this in-between year or two where it was venue prices were like driving everything I was doing pretty much. Sydney is not an affordable place.
That's why you all moved to Adelaide.
Yeah.
So piggybacking off of that, what would you say are the biggest challenges you've faced kind of getting things started? What do you think is the kind of worst thing or the most difficult thing about, I guess, the first year or the first couple of years?
I think, well, for me, I kind of see that the existential threat to the Mega Game group in its early years is you just need to build to that critical mass of players where it kind of, the interest becomes kind of self-sustaining and you don't have to keep stoking it with new games like every couple of months. And that's tough in the early days when you're reliant on on like one or two kind of like groups or communities, like if one's a university club and another is like a board game enthusiasts like social group or something, and you're really trying to, I think the challenge is trying to break out of that so that you can continue to attract new players and ensure that you kind of can continue to grow, which in turn means that you can, you know, you can spend a bit more on your game so you can deliver a higher quality kind of product at the end of the day. I think, well, for me anyway, as we're in the trenches of the first year of Adelaide Mega Games, that's what I see as the main challenge. I don't think, touch wood, I don't think we've had any surprises yet, but then again, I've been a part of this subculture for 10 years now, so that's maybe just me being a bit cynical.
That makes total sense. I think, yeah, I definitely feel that, and I think getting a critical mass of people who are excited and like getting a critical mass of organizers or people who are willing to help run the game is a big one. I definitely think in Brisbane that one of the reasons why we haven't run super huge amount of games is after God Emperor, I was pretty tired of, like, it was a pretty big thing making that game. I was a little burnt out, and so took a break for a bit, and that, you know, without having one person who's really carrying the torch and really pushing things forward, things died off a bit. So I think until you get it to be like almost a self-perpetuating machine, I feel like it kind of needs at least one person who's really excited about things, or hopefully more than that, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely something that I see kind of in the future for Adelaide, and I'm trying to get ahead of it now by like trying to cultivate the like interest of people designing their own games, because I hope you don't mind me saying, Pat, like, but I saw Pat kind of enter a phase of burnout while I was still at Sydney, and I'm sure it'll happen to me as well at some point. So I'm trying to kind of get ahead of that so that there are other people who,
yeah,
as you say, are enthusiastic about a game either that they want to run or one that they are kind of putting together, so that we can kind of, we can keep that steady, steady progress of the group and kind of continue to grow by having you know, a relatively relatively full calendar every year.
Yeah, and I don't think I ever left that bit of burnout, really. Not yet, properly. Which I think is really common, it sounds like, in a lot of places. In Melbourne, Nelly, it sounds like you got your crowd established pretty early and had that momentum going. Have you ever hit any walls yet where it's felt like it's going to fall over because someone's not doing their part or not in a position to do what they usually do? Or have you sort of spread the load evenly enough?
Yeah, so there's some stuff I can't particularly speak to, but we had a pretty rough start of 2022. Mm-hmm. We ended up pulling a game. We were going to run The World Turned Upside Down to kind of coincide with Hamilton coming to Melbourne. And we just timed it like really poorly for a bunch of other things that were happening in our lives. And also, I think we kind of hadn't really realized that the Hamilton craze had really gone by the time it actually came to Melbourne. I'm not sure our community or the community that we've built is particularly like inspired by historical and particularly like war gamey mega games. They tend to like our group loves sci-fi and they like the kind of chaotic whimsy of things like Phase Anatomy. Sci-fi is the popular one, I think, down here. And it did not appeal. And then in the middle of 2022, we ran a pirate mega game that we'd adapted. And in a lot of ways, that game was a huge success. So it was our biggest until a week ago at our like 90-something players. But the venue that we had booked fell apart and we ended up in a slightly smaller venue, so it was super cramped, and that and a couple of other things meant that was probably the most stressful mega game I've experienced as a facilitator. I think a chunk of people probably played that game and never came back, and everyone else was like, oh no, like I had a good time. Like there were definitely like flaws and it like clearly you were all a bit stressed, but like I enjoyed these things, and the further away we get from it, I think the softer those views are, which I appreciate. I still feel very guilty about a lot of what happened with that game.
Right.
But that was probably the hardest point where I was a bit like the World Turned Upside Down hit Tristan really hard. Pirates hit me really hard. Mm. But we kind of, that turned out to be the best way for that to have happened because he actually played Pirates and that like reinvigorated him and how he felt about mega games. And that was also the point where we brought our respective partners in and started moving towards incorporation. And we went for like a quite, I'm going to say easy game in Crisis and Elysium in that game is fully packaged and we could just buy it, produce it and run it with really not having to deal with any kind of difficulties. It was a science fiction game. And we ended up selling out it's like a 60 player game. We ended up selling out two games and that really helped, I think. But I think if Crisis had not been successful, I'm not sure that we would still be here, quite honestly. But Crisis went well. We then incorporated, following suit from Pat in Sydney, and things have generally been pretty consistent since then, I think, but we learnt a huge amount 2022.
Yep. And it's kind of I mean, that whole learning from adversity thing, it's kind of a good thing to go through because you realize it helps you identify the symptoms of things, and like you said, getting Tristan to play in a game was the thing needed for him to perk back up and identify why, you know, remember why he's in the space. It sounds like a lot of things out of your control that all happened at the wrong time. I've definitely had a few moments like that over the years, even just this side of COVID. earlier this year when we're writing the Generalissimo is dead. I mean, this sounds a little bit privileged, but it was the first time we didn't sell out games immediately. Like the moment it goes live, we sell stuff in Sydney because there's a very large crowd here and they want Mega Games. And I think there's a few different reasons for that, but that did have us sort of questioning, like, I don't know, there were some philosophical questions about what are we doing and why. I think it is really important. I think the best way to address some of those moments is to immerse yourself in the games and get to play them if you can, and be involved in the buzz that comes, the energy that comes with these events. Which is what I'm constantly recommending to people who are keen to start running games, and like, make sure you play them, go and get involved in them, hear what the players' experience is like and why they all like it so much, because I think that's the big driving force.
Definitely.
I think for me, particularly talking about community, like, easily top five worst moments of running Mega Games is realizing that a player has had a bad day and I didn't know about it until later, or often it's because there's a mismatch between their preferences and the game we've put on, but sometimes it's fully our fault. And that's truly the worst experience, is to be like, you paid for this experience and it didn't meet your expectations, and there were tangible things that I could have done if I'd known about that 4 hours ago. We're at a point where our community is probably beyond a number of people that I can, like, hold in my head. But often still when we're, like, ticketing events and I'm seeing names come through, I recognize most people who are coming through. And I've put a lot of effort into trying to get to know everyone in our community, and trying to make sure that if someone has a bad time at one of our events, I'm approachable about that and we can talk about what happened. And that's been a really big part of the community building for me personally.
That's fantastic. That's when it really, that's the thing. That's the kind of thing that makes it into a real community, not just, you know, we're selling things to an event that you might attend. It is actual, building a relationship with people, or actually getting involved in it, that kind of makes it all much more meaningful. And I think I was just gonna talk about the thing you said you were talking about, Pat. I think burnout is super real, and it is very easy to, you know, even if you had 70 players and 65 of them had a great time, 4 of them had an okay time, and 1 of them had a terrible time, it is very easy to get really affected by that, and to, you can't be perfect, right? You can't make the perfect experience for every one of those players. Sorry, I forgot
apparently Justin can.
After when I was reading the feedback from So Say We All, like your first run in Melbourne, man, that really destroyed my confidence. I think there was one player who did not have a good time, and I was like, oh my goodness, my game's a disaster.
I can very much assure you that it wasn't, and that we, so for everyone else's context, we had one player in the Discord who had a really bad day and just really kept going about what was wrong, and that none of us knew how to handle this. It got to a point, and I think it was also happening like during the work day, and so we all kept periodically checking Discord and being like, oh my god, it's gotten worse. And that was really difficult for us to handle as well. And to be honest, I'm still not quite sure how I would have done that differently, that player in particular, because I don't think I had at the time the capacity to message them privately and be like, hey, can we take this off the public Discord, because everyone else in that space who had a really good time and has like since come back is having their perception of how this game went colored by how bad of a time you had, and that's not great for everyone. I at some point had a friend say, maybe you shouldn't be the one reading the feedback forms. Maybe you could outsource that to someone who is then just going to give you the, like,
you're going to filter
a few actionable items Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't implemented that, but maybe I should.
Maybe there needs to be like a time delay function as well. It's like people submit their feedback and then a week later it prompts them like, do you still feel this way?
No, that could be well.
Because I've definitely seen like the cooling off period is real.
All right. We got to have a couple of different episodes about this, I think. Feedback, we're going to talk about community. We were just talking before this, before we started recording, about having an episode just about feedback that we've received. But I have a feeling an even more interesting conversation.
Just reading out the worst bits and calling people out.
One day we'll be brave and we'll do that. But I think another conversation that we need to have is how to take feedback and how to use it. I can empathize. I know that the feedback that you get on games, when it is people, I think we talked about this with Johan. We're talking about Event Horizon, and he said something about how there's always that one person who's going to write an essay about mechanics, and they're going to be like, "This is what you should do to the game."
Yep.
And you know, usually there's more than one of those people, and then you've got other people who just like, you know, they were very excited about just their one little story, and so because it didn't go the way they wanted, that they want to tell you about it. But you can really pick separately from those kind of recurring characters, the people who just genuinely didn't have a positive time, and it's not because they didn't like the game or they, you know, something didn't click for them. It's because the event experience just wasn't, it didn't accommodate them. And I know, yeah, that creates some bad feelings, and I know exactly what you mean. So yeah, I think it's something that we should probably unpack, but, yeah, maybe we should progress along though. I was just going to ask, we had a lot of conversation there about community and the players, particularly in Melbourne Deli. Since progressing on from those first games that you ran and building the initial community, how often do you now see the new players? What are you doing to sort of generate new players?
I'm not actually sure that we're doing anything deliberate to get new players. So part of it is that we have now set up a website. That really, I think that only happened. Time is real and can't hurt me. Might have been this year. Might have been the end of last year. I think that's helped. Our Discord is a bit of a mess, but it's very open. Mm-hmm. And so we just see people kind of trickle in. I think people find us through really weird and different ways. But it's mostly people doing, I think, a Google search after having still 10 years later seen the Shut Up and Sit Down video and are like, is there a mega game happening in my city? I don't know if the stats off the top of my head, but I think we usually have a 50-50 split of returning players and new players, and generally what I have gathered is that most people are swayed by the premise of the game. So there are, and I could look at this more closely, there are definitely distinct segments forming around the people who only come to our science fiction games, and the people who will kind of come to everything, and the people who are like, I love mega games but I'm super busy, so I'm coming to one a year and I'm going to come to the one that fits with my schedule the most. So there's people who came to Watch the Skies in 2019 who then didn't come to a game again until 2023. And I was like, oh, I thought we'd lost you. And you're back now. which is really funny. Yeah, I don't know that we are, as with most mega gaming groups, marketing is a challenge. I think we just kind of cruise, to be honest. I know that's not very helpful advice, but it's where we're at.
No, I think it's pretty...
I will say, because we're doing First Contact, there has been, which is a 200-player game, we've been marketing that a little bit more aggressively, sort of, but going to PAX was a big one, I think, for that, and just getting ourselves out there in that capacity. We've been talking to some of the other, like, big gaming groups, by which I mean mostly LARPers, and there's some cross-pollination there. Also, because I'm in the games research community in Melbourne, that's starting to proliferate a little bit. So there's a whole group of people who I spoke to at a conference earlier this year who then bought tickets to First Contact as their first mega game, and I'm like, cool, no pressure then.
It does seem like a common thread here, I think, because of the distance and the geography and the scarcity of games. If the word just gets out, people end up showing up and you don't have to actively pursue it too hard. I know that we, like I said earlier, we were kind of questioning that with running a game earlier this year. But I think one of the biggest drivers of not getting people immediately was that we offered two dates and a lot of people just preferred the second one. Because it's...
That has happened to us before as well.
And so with this game that we were worried was going to be the end of us, well, not really, it's overdramatic, but, you know, we thought the tide was turning and we needed to sort of change direction to make sure that we actually focused on marketing and that kind of thing. We ended up having a huge wait list for it and we've got people really keen to play it again. And it's just sort of, it was just happened to be the timing that made it sort of stand out. But yeah, in the past, in Sydney as well, we haven't had to actively market too hard. And I'm worried for when that runs out, if it does. Because having an organic 50% new player, visit rate, that literally can't last forever. Mm-hmm. It has to stop eventually.
Surely infinite
one day.
growth can just happen, right? Just how this all works.
Sure.
Yeah, I've been sitting for a while on the assumption that at a certain point, if it peters out, I think I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Maybe touching on the burnout point, I think if it naturally ended, I would not, I would move on with my life. That would be okay. I'd come to other states and play mega games when I felt like it. Yeah. But the alternative is that someone starts a second mega gaming group in Melbourne. And I live in a perpetual state of anxiety about this because community is so important to me that if someone were to do that and want to do it commercially or want to be competitive with us instead of collaborate and share games, that would really upset me. But if a second group formed and they were like, hey, we just, want to fill a niche that you're not filling, can we be friends? Great. I'm so here for that. But yeah.
Yeah.
And then you stage the hostile takeover in the background. True mega gamer.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I really...
I'm always scheming.
One of the things I really love about the mega game community is I haven't met really... I don't think we've really seen any groups who are very cutthroat or competitive or that kind of thing, at least around Australia. But
I would hope not.
No, I think there seems to be groups... There's definitely groups that have different cultures and different ideas of how to do things. And they operate differently and they play different types of games and that kind of thing. But I don't think there's any animosity and there's no territorialism or that kind of thing anywhere in the world that I have witnessed. Or maybe it was done so totally that we just never realized they were there because they were taken over. but yeah, I think the space runs on goodwill and people are coming along sort of agreeing to join this crazy thing and help make it a good experience for each other. And I don't think that community lends itself to politicking and fighting over stuff and, that kind of stuff.
I really
hope not. I don't... That's my optimistic note for the episode. I don't think that's what the mega gamers want.
No, that's what they have. Actual
that's right.
Mega games.
They want it in small, controlled doses.
Yeah, they get in their fix. Since you got things going, or at least sort of since you've been part of things going, Justin, have you found there's any trend in Adelaide with the community? Are you needing to actively pursue getting new members, or is there a solid base there that just keeps coming back?
I'm not sure yet. I mean, I feel like it's still kind of early days that the Adelaide mega game group is standing on its own two feet. I mean, with this one that we're running, what we're about to run with Phase Anatomy, this is, our, I guess, our second standalone game and our third ever game. I think we've got, it's kind of a 2/3 returning players, 1/3 new. I think it will take a while for the balance to kind of approach 50-50, especially like when we're just starting out and, you know, marketing is difficult. Well, it's not difficult, but I think no one really has the bandwidth to kind of properly do a good job of it. It's always just kind of like, oh, you know, we'll post this and we'll post this. And it's kind of, you know, in the lead up to a game, you do a whole flurry of activity and then you're kind of quiet for a few months. And then you start to pick back up again and you reach like the fever pitch before your next game. And then, so I think there's probably some like optimization there to be done in order to kind of continue to like propagate awareness out to larger communities, but I'm just too lazy to do it properly.
I definitely feel that. I hate marketing. it's terrible.
Yeah, it's not something that I think the usual people who are drawn to mega games and organizing mega games, they don't seem to cross over a lot with people who like to do marketing and that advertising and that kind of thing. The Venn diagram doesn't seem to be too strong.
Yeah, I think.
Which is funny because, again, mega gamers love to lie. Right.
I think if we went super hard with marketing in Adelaide, I think it might I might end up single because I'd micromanage a lot of Katie's marketing stuff and she doesn't appreciate it.
All right, that's another episode as well, I think.
We've talked a bit about getting new players. How do you all handle getting the organizer control teams together? Like, what do you look for in a good control team person? Like, at the start, at least for us, it was just you get your friends together and you try to get cool people you know and people who are interested. But, yeah, being a bit more down the track, are there things you specifically, like, look for that you what would you say is like the key to having a great team of people to help put these things on?
Yeah, so I think ISIS might also have been the turning point for this. Now often have more people want to facilitate than we can accommodate, which I think is a really fortunate position to be in. But does mean that every time we put on a game, I have to turn around to a bunch of people and be like, I'm really sorry, but we just don't have room for you this time. And I always find myself trying to balance people's feelings with the quality of game that I want to deliver. Mm. And that's hard and I hate it. But with that, there's some, like, we try and balance experienced facilitators with newer facilitators or people who are trying to work on something so that we can balance that and kind of do some mentoring, but we're not quite set up to be able to do that, I think, as well as we'd like. So mostly what happens is that we're taking the people who we know will do a really good job. And then there's also an element of the four of us who run Melbourne Mega Games, you could say, have strong personalities. And so they're like, transparently, there is an element of us picking the people who we like working with and who we can work with when, you know, the game gets to a stressful peak. But the qualities we look for are like a start around charisma, honestly, because you need to be able to engage with the players and like being able to, I guess, understand and teach the mechanics is almost secondary. Being able to understand the mechanics is almost secondary to being able to teach them effectively and work with other people effectively, because we can teach you how a game works, but we can't teach you to identify that player is not having a good experience because of a series of micro expressions that they made and the way that their body language is kind of positioning them in relation to their team, and maybe just keeping an eye on that and then being able to intervene and redirect them. So it's really, we're probably looking for soft skills first before we're looking for game experience. And then we do kind of long-ish facilitator training for each of our games, where we usually try and have the game fully produced by that point, and we play around with the pieces and kind of talk about. We have some principles of good facilitation that are around the types of questions to ask and the types of the, like, kind of the way to structure responses to players, drawing on both mechanics and, I guess, what you'd call the game's values. Does that kind of answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely.
That felt very vague.
I think it's great. I mean, it's a vague question, I guess. It's a lot of it is vibe, I guess, as to who would be a good facilitator. But I think that makes total sense that soft skills are really critical to making sure that people have a good time and you can kind of understand what's going on in the game. Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we should start bringing this one to a close. I guess the big question is, what for all of you, is what would you say is the biggest piece of advice you would give to someone if they are interested in getting a mega game community started for the first time now? Justin, maybe what would you say to that person?
I mean, it sounds cliche, but just do it. there are always, you know, I mean, speaking from my own experience, moved to Adelaide and it was 3 years before I actually did anything. There are always kind of reasons not to do things. You know, you're always busy, you've always got stuff on the go. And the, you know, those convenient opportunities that are, you know, that really kind of push you forward don't come along that rarely. So, yeah, just make a plan and just go for it. And it will all kind of, I think it should all kind of work itself out. You know, you'll learn the you'll learn the skills that you need on the go. You know, Pat and Jack are kind of the best examples here that really started solo without anyone else to draw from. But yeah, just go for it, I think, and let the chips fall where they may.
That's great advice.
Feels like such an Australian thing to say.
She'll be right.
Just do it, just mate. It'll be fine. Pat, what would you say if you had any advice?
Well, I've got two answers, and the first one is pretty much the same as Justin. I think you got to jump in. I guess I would refine it by just saying, don't plan too far ahead. Just get a game done, run an event, and then worry about everything else, including all the stuff we've just been talking about, marketing,
true,
building a community, standardizing how you run your events, making sure your budget's good. Worry about all of that after you've run your first one, because you won't know until you've run one event whether or not you're going to keep doing it and whether or not it's for you. So fast track yourself to running that first one, whether it means using Watch the Skies, like everyone always does, as the intro, or some other game that's off the shelf and ready to go and has a brand that will get people involved. Lean on other communities, lean on other people who've done it, get them to come and help you run it or fill seats. But just really get the event done. You got to run something before you can start building something bigger. So that's my just do it, answer. I guess my other answer is, maybe this comes after the first event and you need to figure out, how do I now grow this community? I think you need to be very clear with yourself about why you're doing it. You need to figure out what's driving you, because otherwise you will. Yeah, I think that's, not being self-aware of that could very well lead you to the burnout and the crashing and burning. I think that the answer to that is very different for a lot of people, but I think you need to, once you've run your first event, you need to be able to articulate to yourself at least why it is that you liked that thing and why you want to keep doing it and why you're willing to subject yourself to what will be hundreds of hours of work that sort of pays off in one day, this just rush of chaos, and then you're very tired the next day.
Very true. It's a very odd hobby, isn't it? You're putting your all in work.
It's a little bit masochistic, but yeah. Which is why I think you need to be sure. I think some people like the idea of running mega games, or they like the idea of mega games, or they're really keen to have run a mega game. But you need more than that, I think, if you want to if you want to do it well and happily.
Very true, I think. And I think the only... Yeah, I think the Just Do It advice is great. I think as long as you, have some basic care for people and you care about people having a safe and comfortable experience, then everything else I feel like will be okay, ultimately. Like, you know, it doesn't... It is kind of okay if a mega game has kind of rubbish rules. Like, as I feel like the enthusiasm and the... the amount of passion that people bring to it really elevates these experiences. Even if, you know, I could go back to my first run of Watch the Skies and talk about hundreds of things that I did wrong, like, it was still, people had a great time. Like, it was, you know, it, things kind of worked out, and so far they have still been working out. Nelly, what would you say?
I am 100% on the Just Do It train. I completely agree with everything that Justin and Pat said. My Just Do It Plus is, there's a reason that Watch the Skies is the one that everyone uses as the first game. Like, if you're unsure, just do Watch the Skies. People will come to Watch the Skies. People have seen the video.
Warts and all.
But my, oh, yeah. Like, it's been 10 years. It is doing a lot of heavy lifting for us. I think my actual piece of advice is a little bit to the left, though. And this is not a dunk on either of you, Pat and Jack. Do it with someone else. Don't do it on your own. Particularly, I think this ties to what Pat was saying about ask yourself why you're doing this and how you feel about it. It is better when you are doing it with someone else for so many reasons. I think it is better for shaping the community when you've got diverse people, like, and even just in terms of personality, trying to share that load. It is less work for you. You will learn a lot from that experience, like, on a selfish level. And also, I think a lot of the joy that I have had in running May Games has come from doing it with Tristan and now with Leon and Yolanda, and that team, and how much we... like, are able to care about each other in that space and support each other, means that I am still so happy to be running my games 5 years later, despite some of the stuff that's happened. My piece of advice is build a micro community in your organizational team, as well as building out a community of players.
That's a fantastic piece of advice. I think, yeah, getting a wide variety of different viewpoints is really, it helps you so much in terms of bouncing ideas off people, or just, yeah, thinking of things that you wouldn't have thought of. Even if you can get just one person who kind of gets it and is as excited about things as you are, it is huge for your amount of passion and how much you can put into the game.
Yeah, I do have a question about that that's just sparked to mind, and for Pat. When you brought James and I on to help you with As the Fire Dies, that was, I think, your kind of first collaborative mega game experience, right? You'd been kind of a one-man band before that. How did you find that experience?
I'll ask the questions here, Justin.
This is my podcast. I get to...
All right, I'll start the Greater Game podcast then.
Please.
We'll have to retaliate by starting the Greatest Game podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, no, leave that for me.
It was only, I wouldn't say it was the first. I think it would be a discredit to say, to some people, to say it was the first time, but it was definitely the most structured. My memory is that of an old man's, so I can't go into a lot of detail on what that experience was like. But I think I quite liked that experience more than other collaborations I've done in the past. I think because the chemistry, like, we clicked, we understood what we were all doing, and we all had the same vision. I also felt like there was a bit of a, I don't know, I saw that experience as about transferring knowledge to you guys. So it was more like a, this is this weird thing I've been doing for the last few years, have a look how I do it. And then you were able to contribute to that and come up with other ways of doing things, which was good. I would like to say that now that you're off in another city doing mega game stuff, it was successful.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. I think the collaboration thing is very important. I am self-aware enough to say that I'm not a great collaborator sometimes, because, well, for a lot of reasons, I'm not going to psychoanalyze myself now. However, I would only caveat the thing about getting a team and doing it with someone else, that depending on the environment that you're in, that will sometimes be counter to the just do it mentality, which is you really need, if you're going to get a partner or another, you know, a team to help you start, kick things off, everyone needs to be invested and on the same page, because if the team is not sort of equally driven, then things could fall over. There's more points that allow things falling over, I suppose. That hasn't sort of stopped me from trying to put teams together and eventually assemble the team that I've got now. But over the years prior to that experience with you, Justin, I had done pseudo development and design stuff with different people, but the energy and effort that was able to be brought was not sort of matched, I suppose. And sometimes it falls back on one person, which is any relationship, I suppose.
That's fair. I don't want to steal any glory for our first run of Watch the Skies. I had a huge amount of people who were crazy helpful for that run. A lovely player in the press team, Gordy Higgins, stepped up and did full graphic design for all the rule books. You know, too many people to name, but
yeah,
it's so much easier with people helping you out there with you.
I will say on that, I have done potentially a disservice to all of the people who have helped us run our games who are outside of myself, Leon, Yolanda, and Tristan, because since the arc, we've been putting together what we call a logistics team. But we have changed that every game to kind of give a few people a chance to help us run a mega game without the whole responsibility of doing it. And like all of those people have done a huge amount of work and we're very, very appreciative of that. So I just want to shout that out at the end there.
For sure. Every game requires quite a team behind it.
There's so many unsung heroes in every mega game community.
Awesome. Well, I think that brings our conversation to a close. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. I really appreciate these. It was really lovely to just get a chat, with some different perspectives of different getting started points and things like that. I'll just quickly go around the grounds. Nelly, did you have anywhere that people should go or anything you wanted to chat about with or shout out with Melbourne Mega Games and the things they're up to right now?
I mean, if you are in Australia, come play First Contact with us on the 31st of August. All of the details are on our website at melbourne-mega-games.com. Also, depending on when this airs, we will be running the ARC again for, I think, up to 88 players is probably where we're going to cap it. With the Free Play Festival on the 1st of June, and that information will be coming out in April. Otherwise, join us on Discord or on Instagram is pretty much those are the two places that we are mostly active.
Awesome. Yes, I'll be there. It'll be absolutely amazing for First Contact. Can't wait. And Justin?
Yeah, you can find Adelaide Mega Games we have a Discord server of our own as well, and also on Instagram. We do have a token Facebook account, but as Jack's already outlined, Facebook's a bit of a dying platform, so we're kind of only there out of obligation. And we've got, we're about to run our first game for the year in a week's time, and then our next game will be in towards the end of July, not yet announced, so stay tuned. It's probably be announced by the time this is aired, but I'm going to maintain the mystery.
You're going to hear first. New game.
Yeah, ooh. Original game.
Wonderful. Well,
very exciting.
I think if you're listening to this, you probably know where to find me and Pat, but if you had any chat or comments or anything about this, check us out at the Great Game Pod Discord and shoot us a comment or anything like that. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.